Hello, this is Melanie Guralnick, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the November 25th, 2025 issue of the Toronto Sun on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The first story is Campbell's Soup Executive Caught in Recording Ripping Poor Customers in Derogatory Rant by Danette Wilford. A Campbell's Soup executive is accused of making disparaging comments about their employees and the customers who buy their products. Martin Bally, Campbell's Vice President and Chief Information Security Officer, allegedly made the offensive remarks during a November 2024 meeting that was secretly recorded by Robert Garza, a former cybersecurity analyst with the company. Garza said he had a gut feeling that, quote, something wasn't right with Martin, so he set up a sit-down with Bally to discuss his salary and decided to record it, WDIV reported. On November 20th, Garza filed a lawsuit alleging racist remarks, admissions of drug use at work, and retaliation after he reported it. Campbell's Soup Company, Bally, and supervisor J.D. Opperell are named as defendants in the suit. What the Campbell's VP allegedly said. In the recording, a voice alleged to be Bally's can be heard blasting Campbell's products and mocking its customers. We have shit for fucking poor people. Who buys our shit? I don't buy Campbell's products barely anymore. The man alleged to be Bally is heard saying. It's not healthy now that I know what the fuck's in it, Bally allegedly said before going on to rip apart the soup's ingredients. Bioengineered meat? I don't want to eat a piece of chicken that came from a 3D printer. Bally also allegedly made derogatory comments about certain minority workers at the company. Fucking Indians don't know a fucking thing, the voice purported to belong to Bally said. They couldn't think for their fucking selves. Employee explains why he recorded exec. Garza had only been working for the company for 2 months before the conversation took place. He has no filter, Garza said of Bally to the outlet. He thinks he's a C-level executive at a Fortune 500 company, and he could do whatever he wants because he's an executive. Garza told WDIV that he felt pure disgust from the meeting, and again after listening to the rant. He initially kept the recording to himself, but decided to report the disturbing comments to his supervisor. Garza was terminated 20 days later. Garza's complaint accuses the company of maintaining a racially hostile work environment, and alleges the termination was retaliatory while he was, quote, really sticking up for other people. What Campbell's had to say. A Campbell's spokesperson told the New York Post that Bally has been placed on temporary leave while they conduct an internal investigation. If the comments were in fact made, they are unacceptable. They do not reflect our values and the culture of our company, the spokesperson said. We are proud of the food we make, the people who make it, and the high-quality ingredients we use, they continued. The comments heard on the recording about our food are not only inaccurate, they are patently absurd. The company added that it was not aware of the recording before Garza's lawsuit was filed. Garza told WDIV that he raised concerns with human resources but did not hear back. It took Garza 10 months to find another job. He called Campbell's handling of the situation simply terrible. They have a motto. We treat you like family here at Campbell's. Come work for us, Garza said. That's not the case. Garza is seeking damages for wrongful termination and retaliation. That story was Campbell's Soup Executive Caught in Recording Ripping Poor Customers in Derogatory Rant by Danette Wilford. The next story is Could Blue Jays Target Japan's Newest Pitching Phenom After His Dodgers Diss? By Rob Longley. The courtship of big-name Japanese pitchers is an all-too-familiar dance for the Blue Jays, and 28 other Major League Baseball teams, an ultimately futile pursuit over the past two winters. But could things finally be playing to a different narrative for the latest potential ace, Tatsuya Imei, who has hit the free agent market with the intent of being the latest star from his country to make the transition to North America? Imei, who starred with the Cebu Lions in his homeland, I hope I said that right, essentially has declared that he has no interest in following in the footsteps of compatriots Shohei Ohtani, Roki Sasaki, and Yoshinobu Yamamoto, and land in Los Angeles with the powerhouse World Series champions. In fact, Imei has gone out of his way to diss the Dodgers in comments he made on the Japanese show Hodo Station. "Of course I'd enjoy playing alongside Ohtani, Yamamoto, and Sasaki," Imei said, as translated by MLB.com. "But winning against a team like that and becoming a world champion would be the most valuable thing in my life. If anything, I'd rather take them down." Brash talk for the latest Japanese star, and a mindset that would have been music to the ears of Scott Boras, the super agent who represents Imei and will be shopping him aggressively in the weeks ahead. So, why wouldn't he want to play with established Japanese stars who could help bridge the cultural gap? Imei said he wants to embrace the challenge. "If there were another Japanese player on the same team, I could ask them about anything, right?" Imei told Hodo Station host and former MLB pitcher Daisuke Matsusaka. "But that's actually not what I'm looking for. In a way, I want to experience that sense of survival. When I come face to face with cultural differences, I want to see how I can overcome them on my own. That's part of what I'm excited about." Why Imei? What's to like about the latest potential Japanese sensation? Imei is exiting a terrific season with the Lions that saw him pitch to a shutdown 1.92 ERA over 163.2 innings while striking out 178 hitters. With a fastball that hits the 95-mile-per-hour range, the 27-year-old makes the best of his 5'11", 154-pound build with action that North American scouts believe will play well in MLB. With Boras doing the negotiating, it's expected that Imei, who was posted on November 19, will attract a contract that will top $100 million U.S., well below the stratosphere of Dodgers aces Yamamoto and Ohtani. Imei has been one of the top starters in the Nippon Professional Baseball League since 2021, making three NPB All-Star teams since then. Given the success of Ohtani and World Series MVP Yamamoto, no need to remind Blue Jays fans, Imei undoubtedly will be a hot commodity. "When you watch him pitch, he leaves an indelible mark on you," Boras told reporters at the GM meetings. "You always remember what you saw and how that type of talent has converted over here." Will the Jays be serious suitors? Jays GM Ross Atkins has for the most part been an adept poker player this time of season in terms of protecting his hand and keeping his cards close to the vest. That cover was blown late in the process each of the past two seasons, when the Jays went deep only to lose out on high-end free agents Ohtani in 2023 and Sasaki last year. But here's what Atkins had to say about Imei when speaking to reporters at the GM meetings in Las Vegas in early November. "A good player with a really interesting arsenal that had an incredible year," Atkins said then. "We've done the background, and we have more work to do on that front. But I'm glad that he's going to be an option for the industry." Clearly, there is much left for interpretation in those comments, but it's equally obvious the Jays will look deeper, especially if the price doesn't get out of control. The Jays certainly have needs in their rotation with Max Scherzer and Chris Bassett hitting free agency following the World Series, and with Kevin Gausman and Shane Bieber headed for the open market following the 2026 campaign. At any rate, talk about MI will continue to escalate and be a hot topic in early December when baseball's winter meetings get underway in Orlando. There is a picture of Tatsuya Imai. He is standing in front of a background that has marketing posters on it. Some are in Japanese, others are in English. And he is wearing a Cebu Lions jersey and a blue hat that has the letter L on it. He's looking over his shoulder and holding a right fist up, which is kind of a power pose. Very handsome guy, too. Photo courtesy of Kyoto News via AP. That story was, Could Blue Jays Target Japan's Newest Pitching Phenom After His Dodgers Diss? By Rob Langley. The next story is, Ontario Targets Dangerous Driving with Tough Measures in New Legislation, by Jane Stevenson. Premier Doug Ford is making good on a promise he made to the family of Andrew Castillo, a 35-year-old father of three who was killed in a head-on collision this summer. His government introduced tough new measures to tackle dangerous driving. They include a lifetime driving ban for anyone convicted of dangerous driving causing death and roadside license suspensions for dangerous driving behavior. Castillo was killed on August 3rd after being hit by a driver charged with dangerous driving and stunt driving. No family should ever face the heartbreak of losing a loved one or the trauma of a life-changing injury because of a dangerous and careless driver, said Transportation Minister Prabhmeet Sarkaria. These proposed changes will deter reckless behavior, hold offenders accountable, and make our roads and highways safer. Many of the measures being introduced are in response to an Andrew's Law petition in memory of Castillo. Andrew's Law Petition. Following Castillo's death, his family launched the petition calling for tougher penalties for dangerous driving and increased driver education. Andrew deserved better, and families deserve real protection. Andrew's Law makes sure of it, said Andrew's brother, Jordan Castillo, in a statement. The government's proposed measures include giving police the power to immediately suspend a driver's license for 90 days and impound a vehicle if they have reason to believe a person is driving dangerously. The 18-year-old man, charged in Castillo's crash, has also been charged after a car hit an OPP vehicle that Ford was traveling in on Highway 401 in January. Ford met with Castillo's family in the summer and pledged to bring forward legislation in response to the family's petition. Roadside license suspensions. For those caught driving with a suspended license, the legislation calls for fines ranging from $2,000 to $10,000 and vehicle impoundment for 14 days for the first offense. Fines and impoundment periods go up for those caught more than once. The new legislation is also proposing a new 7-day roadside license suspension for careless driving and a 30-day suspension for careless driving causing bodily harm or death. Fines would also increase to $1,000 to $5,000, up from $400 to $2,000, upon conviction for careless driving. The government is also exploring measures to support family members of those killed by impaired driving. This includes consulting on measures that would make impaired drivers who caused the death of a parent or guardian responsible for financial support of the victim's children. There is a picture of Andrew Castillo with his family. They appear to be at a restaurant. Andrew is wearing a light blue jacket. He's got a great smile, brown eyes, a mustache and short beard, brown hair. He's got his arm around his wife's back, who is also brunette, long hair, and she's wearing a really great pink suit. And then they've got their arms around their three daughters' shoulders. They're darling, these little girls with light brown hair. Photo courtesy of GoFundMe. That story was called Ontario Targets Dangerous Driving with Tough Measures in New Legislation, by Jane Stevenson. The next story is, brr, polar vortex to put the chill on much of Canada this winter. By Spiro Papakoski. Many Canadians should prepare to bundle up with extra layers in the coming weeks. That's because a polar vortex will send colder Arctic air masses farther south this winter. According to the Weather Network, an extreme warming event happening in the upper stratosphere has the potential to disturb the polar vortex and send temperatures plunging well below freezing, starting sometime in December. The weather event is also one of the earliest on record. What is a polar vortex? The polar vortex is a large area of low pressure and cold air which hovers thousands of meters over the Earth's north and south poles. The counterclockwise flow of air, which doesn't exist at ground level, is stronger during the winter months but weakens during the summer. When the polar vortex is disrupted in the northern hemisphere, it collapses and sends freezing temperatures with the jet stream farther south over a larger area. This phenomenon, called a sudden stratospheric warming, is not only experienced in North America, but in Europe and Asia as well. The Weather Network says the polar vortex has been disrupted only 3 times in November, since it was first documented 70 years ago. During those weather events in Canada, temperatures in December dropped to insanely frigid levels. Despite that, areas in the Arctic could see higher than normal temperatures during these weather patterns, as the colder air is displaced and no extra cooling is created. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Sun on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. More snow? With colder temperatures comes with a higher chance of snow. According to Severe Weather Europe, the latest forecast data shows the potential for higher snowfall accumulation beginning in December. That's because a weak or disrupted polar vortex leads to a snowy start to winter. Long-range forecast. At the beginning of December, southern Canada is expected to be colder than usual. By the end of the month, that cold air mass will continue to flow into the northern, central, and eastern United States, ensuring a white Christmas and New Year's holidays. The weather pattern could continue well into January as a high-pressure area over Greenland and the North Pacific will keep temperatures below normal by midwinter. Keeping up to date. While there is no cause for concern, people can stay informed by following the latest local forecast and any special weather statements from the Environment Canada. That story was, Brrr! Polar Vortex to Put the Chill on Much of Canada This Winter, by Spiro Papakoski. The next story is, Lily. Melanie Joly eyes Paris ambassador role as Carney plans major cabinet overhaul, by Brian Lilly. Speculation out of Ottawa is that Melanie Joly could leave cabinet in a matter of weeks if the right appointment came along. According to multiple sources, Liberal and otherwise, Joly is looking to be appointed Canada's ambassador to France. That job in Paris includes invites to all the best parties and offers wonderful accommodations at the historic Hotel de Rignier in Paris's prestigious 8th arrondissement. That's situated right near the Élysée Palace, the official residence of the French president. It would be a funny coincidence if Prime Minister Mark Carney shuffled Joly off to Paris to ensure she isn't part of his government anymore, since the job is currently held by Stéphane Dion. In 2017, Justin Trudeau sent Dion packing to Europe to get him out of his cabinet, appointing him ambassador to Germany at first and then France in 2022. Joly is currently serving as industry minister and has received mixed reviews, though news of her potential departure has been welcomed by several Liberals contacted about this story. A wave of departures among senior Liberals. If Joly does leave, and sources say it will happen within weeks and not months, she would join Chrystia Freeland, Bill Blair, and Jonathan Wilkinson in departing. Blair is reportedly in line to become Canada's High Commissioner in London. Wilkinson is looking for an ambassadorship to the European Union in Brussels, and Freeland has been named the next Warden of Rhodes House and CEO of the Rhodes Trust. The diplomatic appointments have not been made official yet, as Carney's team looks to line up a number of departures to have a unified by-election date in the new year. This is all part of a plan to shed Trudeau-era deadwood and have Carney attract new faces and new talent to try to put his own stamp on the Liberal Party. Cabinet shuffle expected before Christmas. There could also be other potential departures as well, along with the real risk for Carney if all these moves happen at once. There is continued speculation over a cabinet shuffle in coming weeks, one potential timeline being the week of December 15, the week after the House rises for the Christmas break. It would be beyond strange for a new government to have three cabinets in a year. But as Carney learns the political ropes and assesses the capabilities of ministers, another shuffle is possible. If he goes ahead, look for Lena Diab to be dropped from immigration, where her performance has been unstable at best, and Gary Ananda-Sangari to be shuffled out of public safety, though, unlike Diab, he may get another position. Rumors also continue to swirl about Carney's desire to drop Stephen Guilbeault, a former environment minister who still thinks he occupies that file and is at odds with the current prime minister on issues such as natural resource development. Liberal risks and opportunities in early 2025. Holding by-elections for four or more ridings at once early in the new year could be a risk, but given that the NDP is leaderless and in disarray, and that the Conservative Party is focused on the leadership review of Pierre Poilievre, it could work out well for the Liberals. When he won the leadership of the Liberal Party in March, Mark Carney had clearly inherited a party pieced together by Justin Trudeau. As he plans for the next general election, perhaps as soon as next spring, Carney wants to ensure the party resembles his vision and not Trudeau's. Perhaps he saw that he dropped Trudeau's feminist foreign policy term over the weekend. Carney needs new talent for high-profile ridings. The difficulty for Carney is that he needs and will want to attract top talent to run in these high-profile ridings in Toronto, Vancouver, and Montreal. He still only has a minority government, which means a lack of stability and job security for those he is trying to recruit. Still, expect big changes for the Liberals in the coming weeks, and a new face on the party by next spring, just in time for that early election. That story was Lily. Melanie Joly eyes Paris ambassador role as Carney plans major cabinet overhaul, by Brian Lilly. The next story is Hurry and Love Hard. Nova Scotia curling legend Colleen Jones dies at 65. By Glenn MacDonald. Colleen Jones, the greatest curler Nova Scotia has ever produced, died Tuesday after a long battle with cancer. She was 65. Jones' son, Luke Saunders, announced his mother's passing on her X feed. "Mom had been fighting and trying to beat back cancer over the last 3 years or so," Saunders wrote. Late this morning, while looking out at the ocean from her favorite spot in Mater's Cove, with my dad, brothers, and myself beside her, Mom passed away. Please think of your favorite Colleen Jones moment. Cherish it. Hurry and love hard. During her illustrious curling career, Jones won 6 national titles and 2 world championships. She was also a 2-time Canadian mixed champion and a world senior title holder. Jones was inducted into Canada's Sport Hall of Fame in 2016, and 6 years later was appointed to the Order of Canada. In June, Jones was among two athletes, two teams, and two builders named as the 2025 inductee class into the Nova Scotia Sport Hall of Fame. Jones attended the news conference in a wheelchair pushed by Luke, a mere 24 hours after she underwent hip replacement surgery. She said in an interview on June 11 that she wouldn't miss hearing her name called to the hall. "Our mantra in curling was, 'Let's strive to be great today,'" Jones said in an interview that day. "Let's be great on the ice today. Let's not worry about tomorrow's game. Let's not worry about the game we played yesterday that wasn't so good. Let's focus on this moment." She added that the call to the hall in her home province is the icing on the cake. Jones made 21 appearances at the Scotties Tournament of Hearts National Championships and played more Scotties games than any curler in Canadian history. She was also the youngest skip ever to win a Canadian women's title in 1982. She spent nearly 40 years with CBC News as a reporter and host before retiring from broadcasting in 2023. Jones is survived by her husband, Scott Saunders, sons Zach and Luke, and one grandson. That story was Hurry and Love Hard. Nova Scotia curling legend Colleen Jones dies at 65, by Glenn MacDonald. The next story is Shot Man Brought to North York Hospital Dies, Man Shot in Entertainment District, by Cynthia McLeod. A man is dead after a shooting Tuesday morning in North York. Toronto police in 31 Division say a man was brought to a hospital suffering from gunshot wounds around 5:25 a.m. He died in hospital. The homicide unit is investigating. There was no immediate word on the victim's age, where the shooting occurred, or any suspects. Man shot in Toronto Entertainment District. Toronto police are probing a shooting that occurred early Tuesday in the city's entertainment district. Officers were called to the south side of King Street West, west of Spadina Avenue, around 4:45 a.m., and found a man in his 20s outside with gunshot wounds. Police said life-saving measures were performed and the victim was transported to hospital by emergency run. His injuries are described as serious, but not life-threatening. "We received numerous calls from witnesses advising of multiple gunshots being heard and a male being shot," Toronto Police Inspector Dan Pravica told reporters at the scene, noting the shooting happened when it was still dark outside. "We're relying right now on video canvas and following up with some of those witnesses who either heard and or saw potentially some of the interaction." King is closed to traffic between Spadina and Brant Street as police investigate. There was no immediate word on any suspects. Driver charged in hit run in downtown Toronto. A commercial truck driver has been charged with failing to remain after a pedestrian was hit in downtown Toronto on Monday. Toronto police say around 4:10 p.m., a white Hino truck was northbound on Beverly Street near Grange Avenue, near the Art Gallery of Ontario, when a 40-year-old woman crossing Beverly from the west to the east side was hit. She was taken to hospital with life-threatening injuries. Cops allege the driver did not remain at the scene. Olus Gunn Stephen Olamiu, 56, of Toronto, was later arrested and charged with leave accident scene cause bodily harm and careless driving cause bodily harm. Anyone with information is asked to contact police at 416-808-1900. Man charged in firearm probe. Toronto police say officers in their Integrated Gun and Gang Task Force began an investigation into an individual believed to be in possession of a firearm. On November 22, they executed a search warrant at a residence in the area of Mount Pleasant Road and Broadway Avenue, and allegedly seized a loaded semi-automatic handgun and a quantity of ammunition. Derek Bowyer, 41, of Toronto, was arrested and charged with possession of a firearm knowing its possession is unauthorized, possession of a loaded and prohibited or restricted firearm, and two counts of possession of a prohibited device and ammunition. Bowyer is also charged with two counts of possession of a firearm and ammunition contrary to a prohibition order. Anyone with information is asked to contact police at 416-808-2510 or Crime Stoppers anonymously at 416-222-8477. Man accused of sexual assault. A man has been charged in an alleged sexual assault from last year. Toronto police say they were made aware this month of an alleged assault from 2024. Cops said the accuser was in the entertainment district when the accused invited the victim to his apartment, where the alleged sexual assault occurred. On November 20th, Justin Aguiar, 28, of Toronto, was arrested and charged with sexual assault. He is to appear at the Ontario Court of Justice on Armory Street on January 14, 2026. Anyone with information is asked to contact police at 416-808-1400 or Crime Stoppers. That story was Shot Man Brought to North York Hospital Dies, Man Shot in Entertainment District by Cynthia McLeod. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Sun on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The next story is CRA Snitch Line Generates $490 Million in Unpaid Taxes Since 2018. Report by Post Media News. This just in, there is a tax evasion tip line in Canada. Apparently, Canada Revenue Agency has collected $490 million in unpaid taxes since 2018 by following up on tips from informants who call the tip line, according to Blacklock's reporter. According to in-house research, however, most Canadians don't want to become informants because they consider other people's tax planning none of their business. Since 2018, the agency has assessed approximately $490 million in additional federal taxes and penalties through information from the Offshore Tax Informant Program, CRA wrote in an inquiry of ministry tabled in the Commons. Confidential tips were a key part of the agency's efforts to fight international tax evasion and tax avoidance, it said. An average of 109 tips were received yearly that resulted in the identification of almost 950 taxpayers for audit since 2018, said the inquiry. Conservative MP asked for the figures. The figures were disclosed after a request by Conservative MP Eric Lefebvre. The program promises payments of 5% to 15% of recovered taxes, but the CRA won't say how much it is dished out to tipsters. Due to fluctuating volumes of payments year over year and the need to ensure the confidentiality and security of informants, the Revenue Agency does not disclose the precise number or the amount of payments that were issued to informants each year, wrote managers. However, the agency can confirm payments to informants have been made. Cabinet launched the tip line in 2014. Payments only went to tipsters once all taxes have been collected and appeal rights have been exhausted by the taxpayer involved, Ted Cook, then senior tax legislation chief with CRA, testified at 2014 hearings of the Senate National Finance Committee. That story was CRA Snitch Line Generates $490 Million in Unpaid Taxes Since 2018. Report by Post Media News. The next story is editorial. Hamas gets a pass as it invades Canada. By Post Media News. Just because Prime Minister Mark Carney has recognized the state of Palestine, even though none of his conditions for recognizing it have been met, there is no reason to ignore the growing infiltration of Hamas and other Islamic terrorist groups into Canada. Canada has listed Hamas, aka the Islamic Resistance Movement, as a terrorist organization since 2002, describing it as a, quote, radical Islamist nationalist terrorist organization that emerged from the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood in 1987. It uses political and violent means to pursue its goal of establishing an Islamic Palestinian state in Israel. Since 1990, Hamas has been responsible for terrorist attacks both against civilian and military targets. But while it's supposed to be illegal to participate in or contribute to any activity by Hamas, the reality is it's thriving in Canada. Terror group reportedly thriving in Canada. A recent report by Stuart Bell and Jeff Semple for Global News, based on intelligence sources, said there are 450 people in Canada with ties to Hamas, including senior officials, some with Canadian citizenship and permanent resident status. While President Donald Trump is moving to ban chapters of the Muslim Brotherhood in the U.S., Canada has ignored taking similar action here, even though the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood was the forerunner of Hamas. This, despite warnings from former federal Liberal Justice Minister Erwin Kotler, who describes the Brotherhood as, quote, a standing threat to Canadian national security, to Canadian values, and to our own shared identity and commitment. No greater threat to national security. As reported by the Toronto Sun's Brian Pasifumi, among those who want Canada to outlaw the Muslim Brotherhood is Imam Mohammed Tawhidi, head of the Global Imams Council. Let me be unequivocal, Tawhidi said at a national conference on peace and security in Ottawa last week. There is no threat greater to national security today than the Muslim Brotherhood. In its reach, in its ideological influence, in its ability to infiltrate, manipulate, and mobilize. This is not rhetoric, it is reality. Post Media's Warren Kinsella has reported extensively on the Canadian network of so-called charities, paid protesters, professional organizers, lobbyists, NGOs, unions, and other associations working together to promote Hamas propaganda in Canada through the relentless vilification of Israel and Jews, resulting in an explosion of anti-Semitism. We ignore what is happening at our peril. That story was editorial. Hamas gets a pass as it invades Canada, by Post Media News. The next story is Lily. Price hike plan originated with Doug Ford government, not LCBO, by Brian Lilly. The plan to hike booze prices in Ontario didn't originate from the LCBO, as first thought, but with Finance Minister Peter Bethlen Falvey. A letter sent by Bethlen Falvey to LCBO Chair Carmine Nigro on October 15 laid out in detail exactly what the provincial liquor monopoly would be charging as part of a new wholesale pricing program. After the restaurant, bar, and retail industries erupted in anger, the Ford government tried to make it seem that the proposed January 1 price hikes were the result of the LCBO going rogue. They delayed the changes until April 1, 2026, and attempted to say this was all due to a government agency acting on its own. Instead, as we see in the letter from Bethlen Falvey, the minister goes into specific detail on what level of markup each type of alcohol would be facing under the new system. Changes were dictated by Ford government. the Ontario Restaurant Hotel and Motel Association, in a letter to members, said the changes in pricing structure would mean higher alcohol costs across restaurants, grocery, and convenience sectors, undermining Ontario's competitiveness and affordability. Their estimate was that prices would increase by 10-15% at minimum, with some products going higher, specifically for beer. According to various industry sources, the price consumers would pay for draft beer at restaurants and bars would increase by 40% for major market companies such as Sleeman, Molson, or Labatt, and as much as 70% for draft produced by craft brewers. Bethlyn Falvey's letter to Negro goes into specifics about what level of markup the LCBO should charge based on the type of alcoholic beverage and the level of alcohol in the drink. For example, cider with an alcohol by volume level of between 7.1% and 18% faces a markup of 30%. Ready-to-drink cocktails in that range face a markup of 60%. Wine has a 73% markup and spirits 105%, all for the same level of alcohol. None of it makes sense and should have been simplified with the review of pricing that Premier Doug Ford promised in May 2024. The government will also conduct a broader review of taxes and fees on beer, wine, and alcoholic beverages, with the aim of promoting a fairer and more competitive marketplace for Ontario-based products and consumers, a news release from Ford's office said at the time. Ford government has made major improvements, but this is a mistake. That full-scale review, which was supposed to simplify rules and pricing structures, some of which date back to Prohibition, has never been completed. There were some haphazard adjustments in Budget 2025. There were the LCBO's wholesale markup changes announced in October, but no real rationalization of the booze industry to bring it into the 21st century. The Ford government has done more to improve this industry and consumer access to beverage alcohol than any government since the end of Prohibition, but they aren't living up to their promises on this. The entire system needs a rethink, and it looks like bureaucrats or political staff, perhaps both, got lazy along the way and said this is good enough, even if it's not what Ford promised. The price hikes that will come about as a result of these changes also violate one of Doug Ford's key promises, that he would never raise taxes. Under the plan currently in place, the price of beer, wine, and spirits in Ontario will go up. You can quibble and say that it's due to fees and not taxes, but the simple fact is the government is forcing up the price, and I don't think that is what Ford wanted. I also know it's not what he promised. Ontario deserves better, like other provinces. In Quebec, Alberta, and British Columbia, the respective provincial liquor boards earn a greater return per capita than Ontario does, while also charging lower prices and having lower government markups. The LCBO can find ways to increase revenue to the province, while also offering consumers better choices and better prices. It just takes innovative thinking, which is not what is to be found in the letter from Bethlyn Falvey to the LCBO ordering price hikes down to the penny. Ontario consumers deserve better. Premier Ford, and you promised better. It's time to deliver. That story was Lily. Price Hike Plan Originated with Doug Ford Government, Not LCBO, by Brian Lilly. The next story is PM Mark Carney's housing photo op faked. Privy Council Office Admits, by Brian Passifiume. Ottawa. It was all for show. Newly released documents confirm the construction site used as a venue for Prime Minister Mark Carney's September 14 press conference announcing a new federal housing agency was nothing more than an elaborate and costly stage for the cameras. In response to an order paper question filed by Conservative MP Arnold Viersen that asked, who made the decision to temporarily erect unfinished prop houses for the announcement? The Privy Council office admitted it was all for show, describing it as a demonstration by Ottawa-based modular home builder Cavan Homes. Homes bound for the Arctic and Ottawa. The homes have since been disassembled, and the Nunavut home is now on its way to Canada's Arctic for occupancy by family in need, read the PCO's reply. Similarly, the stacked townhomes are being assembled for a project in eastern Ottawa. The PCO also says the lot, owned by the federal government, was an example of federal land that can be utilized for a housing project. None of that, however, was mentioned by either Carney or Housing Minister Gregor Robertson during the announcement meant to launch Build Canada Homes, or BCH. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Sun on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. None of that, however, was mentioned by either Carney or Housing Minister Gregor Robertson during the announcement meant to launch Build Canada Homes, or BCH, the new federal housing agency headed by former Toronto councillor Anna Beleo. The two sets of homes behind me were manufactured in 2 days and assembled on-site in 1 week, Carney said during the announcement from what was, and still remains, a vacant gravel lot on Merivale and Colonnade Roads in Nepean. We held back the workers from finishing it so we could see how things fit together, how the computer design fits together and tailors the structure. Pointing out one of the units still on a flatbed trailer, Carney said it was being shipped to Nunavut. However, he spent the press conference implying the freshly graded lot, absent of buried utilities or roughed-in roads typical of a conventional construction site, would eventually become a new neighborhood. PM accused of creating Potemkin Village. When the Toronto Sun revisited the site a few days later, the housing units were gone, replaced by an excavator and bulldozer grading the lot with gravel. This prompted widespread criticism, with many accusing the government of erecting a Potemkin village for the benefit of the cameras. While the Department of Housing had no comments to add to the response, they said the stunt cost taxpayers $32,707.23. Fed sought prototype build. Kayvon co-founder Frank Cairo told the Toronto Sun the government approached them with plans to demonstrate a prototype build as part of the BCH announcement. The rapid prototype build for this announcement was featuring actual homes, but was never intended to be misunderstood as a housing development site, he said. The Kayvon ABIC team prototype builds our homes prior to mass production. This is what occurred on the Merivale site in Ottawa where the announcement took place. He said the homes used on the site were disassembled and repurposed for a separate housing development in eastern Ottawa. There was no added cost in doing this, as it was synergized with our existing process, Cairo said. We are a proud Canadian company and are doing everything in our power to be part of the solution to the current housing crisis. Franco Turrizano, Federal Director of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, criticized the government for being disingenuous about the announcement. Carney billed taxpayers for a very expensive photo op, he said. Carney shouldn't be billing taxpayers tens of thousands of dollars so he can pretend to be Bob the Builder. That story was PM Mark Carney's housing photo op faked, Privy Council Office admits, by Brian Passafume. The next story is Dear Abby, son invites his rapist father to wedding. by Jean Phillips. Dear Abby, my child, called, quote, Logan, is the product of a sexual assault. He has located his father and formed a relationship with him. Logan didn't know the circumstances of his conception at the time he contacted his father. He has now been made fully aware by our family as to what occurred. Abby, Logan has invited this person to his wedding. I do not want to attend if his father will be present. Logan has told me that this man will be attending and that the problem is my issue. I love my son, but this is beyond traumatic for me. I want to be there for the special day, but I cannot bring myself to be in the same room with the person who assaulted me. This situation has broken my heart. I feel as though my feelings don't matter to Logan, and that he expects me just to push through this, go to the wedding and deal with it. What are your thoughts? Signed, Worst Case Scenario. Dear Worst Case, your son's insensitivity to your feelings is appalling. That he would demand you ignore the fact that you were a rape victim and spend even a minute in the perpetrator's presence is outrageous. Whatever decision you make to move forward is the right one for you. I am so sorry for your pain, which is palpable. The next letter. Dear Abby, I work with a lady who has drama swirling around her constantly. There's always something wrong with work, her house, her family, herself, her pets, etc. Each problem is worse than the next. At first, I was sympathetic and let her vent. Then I realized this is a daily occurrence, and all this negativity is draining, not only to my patients, but also my mental health. I have tried quickly moving past her work area, but she then follows me to mine. When I tried getting to work before she did, she started coming in earlier. When I tell her I need to complete an assignment, she continues to talk. I'd like to put some distance between us. But she's a nice person, and I hate to say, I really can't listen to you complain every day. Any suggestions? Signed, Running Out of Patience. Dear Running, yes, quit being such a nice person yourself and stop letting this coworker use you as a trouble dump. The next time she approaches you, tell her that what she's doing is interfering with your work and sapping your energy, and you can no longer allow it. Say plainly that you need her to stop. If she doesn't, discuss the problem with your supervisor or HR. That story was Dear Abby, Son Invites His Rapist Father to Wedding by Jean Phillips. The next story is Mark Carney Backtracks on Who Cares Comment, Calls It Poor Choice of Words by Jordan Ursett. Mark Carney went elbows down on Tuesday, labeling his controversial comments about trade negotiations with the U.S. as a, quote, poor choice of words. The Prime Minister faced pointed questions from the opposition in the House of Commons for responding with, who cares? When asked Sunday by a CBC reporter if he was talking to U.S. President Donald Trump in an attempt to mend the country's frayed economic relations. Before the election, he promised elbows up, Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre said on Tuesday during question period via the Canadian press. After it was who cares, before the election, he said the tariffs were an existential crisis. Now he says they're not a burning issue. Why is the prime minister before the election so much different than the one after? PM says remark was a mistake. That prompted Carney to offer a mea culpa over his comments, which he made Sunday during a gathering of G20 leaders in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the night of the election, I made a promise to Canadians, Carney said on Tuesday during question period. When I make a mistake, I'll admit it. That was a poor choice of words about a serious issue. Carney also said he expects to announce more federal help for tariff-affected sectors this week. The incident was sparked by Carney seemingly lashing out on Sunday at a follow-up question from the CBC's Ashley Burke, who had earlier asked the PM on the sidelines of the G20 conference whether Trump had, quote, returned your calls or texts without giving a response. Who cares, Carney said. I mean, it's a detail. It's a detail. I spoke to him. I'll speak to him again when it matters. Tense times as trade talks still suspended. Trump abruptly ended trade negotiations with Canada last month in response to an ad paid for by the Ontario government that featured a recording of former U.S. President Ronald Reagan speaking against tariffs. Carney later apologized to Trump for the ads, but trade talks are still suspended. The Prime Minister is considering traveling to Washington next week for a FIFA World Cup event. That story was Mark Carney backtracks on who cares comment, calls it poor choice of words, by Jordan Ursit. The next story is Two Men Sought for Attack on Trans Person in Hamilton, by Chris Doucette. Investigators are appealing to the public for help identifying two men sought for an attack against a member of the transgender community in Hamilton a month ago that is believed to have been hate-motivated. Hamilton police on Wednesday released images of the two unidentified suspects in the alleged hate crime that involved a physical altercation on Hess Street South around 2:30 a.m. on October 25th. And they're hoping someone recognizes the men and comes forward. During the incident, several individuals took part in an assault on a transgender community member, police said in a statement released Wednesday. Video from the area shows portions of the assault and the individuals involved before they left the scene. Police said members of patrol and the hate crime unit are actively investigating the assault. Hamilton police are dedicated to investigating hate and bias-motivated crimes to ensure Hamilton remains a safe and inclusive community. Investigators are appealing to anyone who may have witnessed the incident or may have video footage from the area recorded between 1:30 a.m. and 2:40 a.m. Please contact Detective Lindsay Scott at lscott@hamiltonpolice.ca or call 905-546-5678 or call Crime Stoppers anonymously at 1-800-222-8477. That story was Two Men Sought for Attack on Trans Person in Hamilton by Chris Doucette. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 25th, 2025 issue of the Toronto Sun. Your reader has been Melanie Guralnick. Thank you for listening.